And it's a very exciting 1 year. When we launched it in May of 2009, we actually launched data.gov with 47 data sets. What's really exciting about the first year anniversary is that we've got over 250,000 data sets, over 97 million hits, hundreds of applications that have been developed by third parties, and a global movement around democratizing data with countries like the United Kingdom, Australia, Norway, Canada, to name a few, that have also stood up data.gov websites in addition to the World Bank.
State and local governments as well.
Absolutely, from the city of San Francisco to New York City to the state of Utah, California. What's really exciting is the president's vision of a transparent and open government is being realized, not just in the United States, but globally.
Talk to me a little bit, because the discussion that I often hear about this, and FCW did an editorial that said this is how not to do open government because you're just making data sets available. So talk a little bit about how data.gov fits into the overall picture, because this seems just like this is a very important element, but it is only one element. If it's the only thing you did, it'd be hard to that's not the accomplishment. It's how it fits into the overall picture.
Well, absolutely. I mean, let's just think about what it means to put data out there. For example, when the Department of Defense made the decision to release data around satellites, a lot of people would have said, well, who cares? It's just data around satellites. Or when the Human Genome Project, led by the National Institutes of Health and other world bodies, released that data, that information, the gene sequencing publicly, I'm sure there are critics who said, who cares? It's just a bunch of genomic data. How does that help anything? Well, what happened out of both of those efforts was today, when you and I go into a new town or city, we're able to use, whether it's our iPhone or whether we go to a local rental car company, GPS devices that help us navigate a new city. Breakthroughs in scientific discovery as a result of a decision at the National Institutes of Health to democratize that information led to personalized medicine in ways that we could have never imagined before. In the same way, what we're seeing is as data is being released, whether it's around healthcare, education, energy, environment, is that third parties have already created hundreds of applications that the government didn't spend a penny on or couldn't have even imagined. For example, a team led by Professor Jim Hendler at RPI has developed over 40 applications using semantic web technologies that demystifies the operations of government and also provides vital information to the public to make intelligent choices, whether that's choices around the foods they eat or choices around the neighborhoods people want to live in, or choices around services they apply for.
And lessons learned from this 1 year in this 1 year experiment so far? Are there things that didn't go as planned or actually went better than expected?
Well, what's been really exciting is that there's been a community of innovators that's been born as a result of data.gov. Now, when I talk about semantic web, for example, imagine a world where you had a bunch of people who said, well, it's interesting, you know, you've put a bunch of documents out there, but what, you know, what good does that do? Well, that gave birth to the World Wide Web as we know it with HTML and the ability to share information globally. In the same way as we're democratizing data, what's happening is we're linking open data, so data from the UK, to data in the United States and the World Bank, to data in the city of New York or San Francisco, to where anyone can actually slice and dice information and almost share it with colleagues, researchers, friends, in the same way we share YouTube videos today. That's the promise of data.gov, and what's been exciting is these communities that have been born. The Sunlight Foundation, for example, for $25,000, they launched a competition. And there are a number of applications that were created as a result of this data.gov platform. One of those applications was flyontime.us, which allows anyone to go online and see average wait times at airport security lines or average takeoff times for flights across the country. This is information that's empowering the American people in ways that were not possible before.
And I understand there's going to be not a relaunch, but a facelift, a one-year-old facelift for data.gov?
Well, it's actually a relaunch of the data.gov platform, which includes new data sets, the geographic tagging, the ability to link to data across multiple countries, the semantic web initiatives, the 200-plus applications that are online. So it's not just a facelift, it's a fundamental re-engineering of the entire platform.
And so, as you say, those things all of a sudden incorporate geographic data, other things, so all of a sudden this becomes even more usable.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the exciting things we've seen is also the public has been actively involved. For example, the most popular data set is the worldwide earthquakes. And that was a result of the public after the unfortunate earthquake at Haiti asked for earthquake data. And the data.gov team, we responded by putting that online. And now we've seen numerous applications that have been created. But the source of that data set in terms of the suggestion to put it on data.gov drove the government to quickly put it on data.gov and provide as close to real-time information as possible.
And one of the challenges that I hear from agencies is they often say, well, you know, our data isn't perfect yet. And so they almost are reluctant to make it fully available. And I was talking to a professor and he says, you know what, your data is never going to be fully perfect. But that's something that agencies get uncomfortable with.
Well, I would agree with the professor in terms of the model with data.gov, it's also designed to make sure that we're getting public feedback. So people are letting us know the quality of the data, issues with the data, because if the data lives in a big black box where no one knows there's a problem, what we're going to do is just propagate a culture and an environment of secrecy and closed government. What democratizing this data allows us to do is actually improve it, get real-time feedback, so that we can improve the quality of that data.
I understand that you've also brought on somebody to essentially be the evangelist for data.gov?
Yes, and that's because we've seen a growing community across the country. So Gene Holmes is going to be the evangelist, so decided to bring her on board because what we want to be able to do is we want to make sure that we're nurturing the community of innovators, but also looking at how we can spur innovation when it comes to STEM at the K-12 level. So essentially figuring out how do we create little toolkits that will allow students to actually conduct projects that essentially will create, whether it's applications or visualizations, using data in ways that they couldn't before. So Gene's going to be very active in not only engaging the K-12 community, but also the community of developers in the academic institutions, in organizations like the Sunlight Foundation, and Silicon Valley.
But and I think the most popular misnomer about data, this isn't something that Joe Average Citizen may use, but it's something that they will use almost indirectly that does open government in at least an indirect way.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the platform for innovation because for the average person, what they're going to use is the applications that are created as a result of the data.gov platform. So Microsoft, for example, created an application that allows individuals to look for jobs near where they're standing on their Azure platform. We've seen third parties create applications that allow you on the iPhone to see the latest products that have been recalled on your mobile device. We've seen a number of other applications that have been created. The real measure for success for us is countless applications created that are riding on top of the data.gov platform where you don't even know it's powered by data.gov.
Slightly off topic, but similar. You've been in this job about 18 months now, 19 months, I guess.
Yep.
How are you still liking this?
I'm loving it. It's one of the best jobs I've ever had in my life, and I get to work with some of the smartest people in the world and serve a president who's determined to change the way government works.
And it seems like this is such a unique time, at least in my years of covering this stuff, all these almost alignment of the planets where all of a sudden all this tool, you can create something like data.gov relatively quickly, and all of a sudden this just blossoming kind of happens.
Well, what's exciting is this shows you the power of ideas and a focus on execution. Part of what I've been doing is meeting with a team, iterating, using the agile, not just development methodology, but the agile management methodology, where we iterate, you know, on 48-hour cycles, not launch a project and then come back a year later to see whether it's working or not. So it's a very, very focused initiative with a huge focus on execution.
What's the biggest challenge that you face in the year ahead?
Well, some of the big challenges, of course, in the context of the data.gov platform, are that some of the systems we have in the federal government, unfortunately, are decades behind in terms of technology. Let's take the Patent and Trademark Office, for example. They've, for the last 30 years, they've been relying on outdated technology. They've got to open up dozens of screens to process a single patent. Now, that makes it very, very difficult to actually release that data because the stability of those underlying systems is compromised if millions of people are hitting those transactional systems or in making those investments to be able to create a central warehouse. So that's been one of the big challenges, and of course the big gap between the private sector and public sector when it comes to information technology. And that's one of the reasons that today at NIST, we're very focused around driving the public sector towards cloud computing so we can leverage some of these emerging technologies and create an experience in the public sector for the American people that they should expect in the same way that they're able to check out a book on Amazon or book their favorite restaurant on OpenTable or a flight on Expedia. We want to be able to make sure that their interactions with government are as simple and pleasant as they are in the consumer space. And that's the other challenge we face in the public sector.
And it does seem like there's a whole life cycle of all these tools, the data.gov, the cloud, even the Open Government Initiative. They all fit together to match the strategy that you're trying to carry out.
Yeah, and there's a very simple philosophy. And the philosophy here is that the government doesn't have to own and create everything. We recognize that we don't have a monopoly on the best ideas, and the best ideas don't necessarily live within the four walls of Washington. And if we look at entities like YouTube or Apple, what you realize very quickly is the iPhone store, the genius of that is it isn't Apple that's creating thousands of applications on the iPhone, it's third parties. It isn't YouTube or Google creating thousands of videos. It's the American people and people all over the world that are creating those videos. So the content is king in that case across the board. And what they've been able to do is leverage the ingenuity of the public. In the same way, what we're trying to do is make sure that we create platforms that enable innovation to happen,